Chapter 12. The Evidence of the German Lady's Maid. Monsieur Bouc was looking at his friend curiously.
I do not quite understand you, Monsieur. You were trying to do what?
I was searching for a flaw, my friend.
A flaw?
Yes, in the armor of a young lady's self-possession. I wished to shake her sang-froid. Did I succeed? I do not know. But I know this. She did not expect me to tackle the matter as I did.
You suspect her? Said Monsieur Bouc slowly. But why? She seems a very charming young lady, the last person in the world to be mixed up in a crime of this kind.
I agree, said Constantine. She is cold. She has not emotions. She would not stab a man. She would sue him in the law courts.
Poirot sighed. You must, both of you, get rid of your obsession that this is an unpremeditated and sudden crime. As for the reason why I suspect Miss Debenham, there are two. One is because of something that I overheard, and that you do not as yet know.
He retailed to them the curious interchange of phrases he had overheard on the journey from Aleppo.
That is curious, certainly,
said Monsieur Bouc when he had finished.
It needs explaining. If it means what you suspect it means, then they are both of them in it together, she and the stiff Englishman.
Poirot nodded.
And that is just what is not borne out by the facts, he said. See you, if they were both in this together, what should we expect to find? That each of them would provide an alibi for the other. Is not that so? But no, that does not happen. Miss Debenham's alibi is provided by a Swedish woman whom she has never seen before, and Colonel Arbuthnot's alibi is vouched for by McQueen, the dead man's secretary. No. That solution of the puzzle is too easy.
You said there was another reason for your suspicions of her,
Monsieur Bouc reminded him.
Poirot smiled. Ah, but that is only psychological. I ask myself, is it possible for Miss Debenham to have planned this crime? Behind this business, I am convinced there is a cool, intelligent, resourceful brain. Miss Debenham answers to that description.
Monsieur Bouc shook his head.
I think you are wrong, my friend. I do not see that young English girl as a criminal.
Ah, well, said Poirot, picking up the last passport. To the final name on our list. Hildegarde Schmidt, lady's maid.
Summoned by the attendant, Hildegarde Schmidt came into the restaurant car and stood waiting respectfully. Poirot motioned her to sit down. She did so, folding her hands and waiting placidly till he questioned her. She seemed a placid creature altogether, eminently respectable, perhaps not over-intelligent. Poirot's methods with Hildegarde Schmidt were a complete contrast to his handling of Mary Debenham. He was at his kindest and most genial, setting the woman at her ease. Then, having got her to write down her name and address, he slid gently into his questions. The interview took place in German.
We want to know as much as possible about what happened last night, he said. We know that you cannot give us much information bearing on the crime itself, but you may have seen or heard something that, while conveying nothing to you, may be valuable to us. You understand?
She did not seem to. Her broad, kindly face remained set in its expression of placid stupidity as she answered,
I do not know anything, monsieur.
Well, for instance, you know that your mistress sent for you last night?
That, yes.
Do you remember the time?
I do not, monsieur. I was asleep, you see, when the attendant came and told me.
Yes, yes. Was it usual for you to be sent for in this way?
It was not unusual, monsieur. The gracious lady often required attention at night. She did not sleep well.
Eh bien. Then you received the summons and you got up. Did you put on a dressing gown?
No, monsieur. I put on a few clothes. I would not like to go into Her Excellency in my dressing gown.
And yet it is a very nice dressing gown. A scarlet, is it not?
She stared at him.
It is a dark blue flannel dressing gown, monsieur.
Ah, continue. A little pleasantry on my part, that is all. So you went along to Madame la Princesse, and what did you do when you got there?
I gave her a message, monsieur, and then I read aloud. I do not read aloud very well, but Her Excellency says that is all the better, so it sends her better to sleep. When she became sleepy, monsieur, she told me to go, so I closed the book and I returned to my own compartment.
Do you know what time that was?
No, monsieur.
Well, how long had you been with Madame la Princesse?
About half an hour, monsieur.
Good. Continue.
First, I fetched Her Excellency an extra rug from my compartment. It was very cold in spite of the heating. I arranged the rug over her, and she wished me good night. I poured her out some mineral water. Then I turned out the light and left her.
And then?
There is nothing more, monsieur. I returned to my carriage and went to sleep.
And you met no one in the corridor?
No, monsieur.
You did not, for instance, see a lady in a scarlet kimono with dragons on it? Her mild eyes bulged at him.
No, indeed, monsieur. There was nobody about except the attendant. Everyone was asleep.
But you did see the conductor?
Yes, monsieur.
What was he doing?
He came out of one of the compartments, monsieur.
What?
Monsieur Bouc leaned forward.
Which one?
Hildegard Schmidt looked frightened again, and Poirot cast a reproachful glance at his friend.
Naturally, he said, the conductor often has to answer bells at night. Do you remember which compartment it was?
It was about the middle of the coach, monsieur, two or three doors from Madame la Princesse.
Ah, tell us, if you please, exactly where this was and what happened.
He nearly ran into me, monsieur. It was when I was returning from my compartment to that of the princess with the rug.
And he came out of a compartment and almost collided with you? In which direction was he going?
Towards me, monsieur. He apologized and passed on down the corridor towards the dining car. A bell began ringing, but I do not think he answered it.
She paused and then said,
I do not understand. How is it?
Poirot spoke reassuringly.
It is just a question of times, he said. All a matter of routine. This poor conductor, he seems to have had a busy night. First waking you and then answering bells.
It was not the same conductor who woke me, monsieur. It was another one.
Aha, another one. Had you seen him before?
No, monsieur.
Ah, do you think you would recognize him if you saw him?
I think so, monsieur.
Poirot murmured something in Monsieur Bouc's ear. The latter got up and went to the door to give an order. Poirot was continuing his questions in an easy, friendly manner.
Have you ever been to America, Frau Schmidt?
Never, monsieur. It must be a fine country.
You have heard, perhaps, of who this man who was killed really was, that he was responsible for the death of a little child.
Yes, I have heard, monsieur. It was abominable, wicked. The good God should not allow such things. We are not so wicked as that in Germany.
Tears had come into the woman's eyes. Her strong, motherly soul was moved.
It was an abominable crime, said Poirot gravely.
He drew a scrap of cambric from his pocket and handed it to her.
Is this your handkerchief, Frau Schmidt?
There was a moment's silence as the woman examined it. She looked up after a minute. The color had mounted a little in her face.
Ah, no, indeed, it is not mine, monsieur.
It has the initial H, you see. That is why I thought it was yours.
Ah, monsieur, it is a lady's handkerchief, that. A very expensive handkerchief, embroidered by hand. It comes from Paris, I should say.
It is not yours, and you do not know whose it is?
Oh, no, monsieur.
Of the three listening, only Poirot caught the nuance of hesitation in the reply. Monsieur Bouc whispered in his ear. Poirot nodded and said to the woman,
"The three sleeping car attendants are coming in. Will you be so kind as to tell me which is the one you met last night as you were going with the rug to the princess?"
The three men entered. Pierre Michel, the big blonde conductor of the Athens-Paris coach, and the stout burly conductor of the Bucharest one. Hildegard Schmidt looked at them and immediately shook her head.
"No, monsieur," she said. "None of these is the man I saw last night."
"But these are the only conductors on the train. You must be mistaken."
"I am quite sure, monsieur. These are all tall, big men. The one I saw was small and dark. He had a little moustache. His voice, when he said pardon, was weak, like a woman's. Indeed, I remember him very well, monsieur."
Chapter 13. Summary of the passenger's evidence.
"A small, dark man with a womanish voice," said Monsieur Bouc.
The three conductors and Hildegard Schmidt had been dismissed.
"But I understand nothing, but nothing of all this. The enemy that this wretched spoke of, he was then on the train after all. But where is he now? How can he have vanished into thin air? My head, it whirls. Say something then, my friend, I implore you. Show me how the impossible can be possible."
"It is a good phrase, that," said Poirot. "The impossible cannot have happened. Therefore, the impossible must be possible in spite of appearances."
"Explain to me then, quickly, what actually happened on the train last night?"
"I am not a magician, mon cher. I am, like you, a very puzzled man. This affair advances in a very strange manner."
"It does not advance at all. It stays where it was."
Poirot shook his head.
"No, that is not true. We are more advanced. We know certain things. We have heard the evidence of the passengers."
"And what has that told us? Nothing at all."
"I would not say that, my friend."
"I exaggerate, perhaps. The American hardman and the German maid, yes, they have added something to our knowledge. That is to say, they have made the whole business more unintelligible than it was."
"No, no, no," said Poirot soothingly.
Monsieur Bouc turned upon him.
"Speak, then. Let us hear the wisdom of Hercule Poirot."
"Did I not tell you that I was, like you, a very puzzled man? But at least we can face our problem. We can arrange such facts as we have with order and method."
"Pray continue, monsieur," said Dr. Constantine. Poirot cleared his throat and straightened a piece of blotting paper.
"Let us review the case as it stands at this moment. First, there are certain indisputable facts. This man, Ratchet, or Cassetti, was stabbed in 12 places and died last night. That is fact one."
"I grant it to you. I grant it, mon Dieu," said Monsieur Bouc with a gesture of irony.
Hercule Poirot was not at all put out. He continued calmly.
"I will pass over for the moment certain rather peculiar appearances which Dr. Constantine and I have already discussed together. I will come to them presently. The next fact of importance, to my mind, is the time of the crime."
"That, again, is one of the few things we do know," said Monsieur Bouc. "The crime was committed at 1:15 this morning. Everything goes to show that was so."
"Not everything. You exaggerate. There is certainly a fair amount of evidence to support that view."
"I am glad you admit that, at least."
Poirot went on calmly, unperturbed by the interruption.
"We have before us three possibilities. One, that the crime was committed, as you say, at 1:15. This is supported by the evidence of the German woman Hildegard Schmidt. It agrees with the evidence of Dr. Constantine. Possibility two, the crime was committed later and the evidence of the watch was deliberately faked. Possibility three, the crime was committed earlier and the evidence faked for the same reason as above. Now, If we accept possibility one as the most likely to have occurred, and the one supported by most evidence, we must also accept certain facts arising from it. To begin with, if the crime was committed at 1:15, the murderer cannot have left the train, and the question arises, where is he and who is he? To begin with, let us examine the evidence carefully. We first hear of the existence of this man, the small, dark man with a womanish voice, from the man Hardman. He says that Ratchet told him of this person and employed him to watch out for the man. There is no evidence to support this. We have only Hardman's word for it. Let us next examine the question, is Hardman the person he pretends to be, an operative of a New York detective agency? What to my mind is so interesting in this case is that we have none of the facilities afforded to the police. We cannot investigate the bona fides of any of these people. We have to rely solely on deduction. That, to me, makes the matter very much more interesting. There is no routine work. It is a matter of the intellect. I ask myself, can we accept Hardman's account of himself? I make my decision and I answer, yes. I am of the opinion that we can accept Hardman's account of himself.
You rely on the intuition, what the Americans call the hunch? Said Dr. Constantine.
Not at all. I regard the probabilities. Hardman is traveling with a false passport. That will at once make him an object of suspicion. The first thing that the police will do when they do arrive upon the scene is to detain Hardman and cable as to whether his account of himself is true. In the case of many of the passengers, to establish their bona fides will be difficult. In most cases, it will probably not be attempted, especially since there seems nothing in the way of suspicion attaching to them. But in Hardman's case, it is simple. Either he is the person he represents himself to be, or he is not. Therefore, I say that all will prove to be in order.
You acquit him of suspicion?
Not at all. You misunderstand me. For all I know, any American detective might have his own private reasons for wishing to murder Ratchet. No. What I am saying is that I think we can accept Hardman's own account of himself. This story, then, that he tells of Ratchet seeking him out and employing him is not unlikely and is most probably, though not, of course, certainly true. If we are going to accept it as true, we must see if there is any confirmation of it. We find it in rather an unlikely place, in the evidence of Hildegard Schmidt. Her description of the man she saw in Wagon Lee uniform tallies exactly. Is there any further confirmation of these two stories? There is. There is the button, found in her compartment by Mrs. Hubbard. And there is also another corroborating statement which you may not have noticed.
What is that?
The fact that both Colonel Arbuthnot and Hector McQueen mentioned that the conductor passed their carriage. They attach no importance to the fact, but, monsieur, Pierre Michel has declared that he did not leave his seat except on certain specified occasions, none of which would take him down to the far end of the coach past the compartment in which Arbuthnot and McQueen were sitting. Therefore, this story, the story of a small, dark man with a womanish voice dressed in Wagon Lee uniform, rests on the testimony, direct or indirect, of four witnesses.
One small point, said Dr. Constantine. If Hildegard Schmidt's story is true, how is it that the real conductor did not mention having seen her when he came to answer Mrs. Hubbard's bell?
That is explained, I think. When he arrived to answer Mrs. Hubbard, the maid was in with her mistress. When she finally returned to her own compartment, the conductor was in with Mrs. Hubbard.
Monsieur Bouc had been waiting with difficulty until they had finished.
Yes, yes, my friend, he said impatiently to Poirot. But whilst I admire your caution, your method of advancing a step at a time, I submit that you have not yet touched the point at issue. We are all agreed that this person exists. The point is, where did he go?
Poirot shook his head reprovingly. You are in error. You are inclined to put the cart before the horse, Before I ask myself, where did this man vanish to? I ask myself, did such a man really exist? Because, you see, if the man were an invention, a fabrication, how much easier to make him disappear. So I try to establish first that there really is such a flesh-and-blood person.
And having arrived at the fact that there is, eh bien, where is he now?
There are only two answers to that, mon cher. Either he is still hidden on the train in a place of such extraordinary ingenuity that we cannot even think of it, or else he is, as one might say, two persons. That is, he is both himself, the man feared by Monsieur Ratchet, and a passenger on the train so well disguised that Monsieur Ratchet did not recognize him.
It is an idea, that, said Monsieur Bouc, his face lighting up.
Then it clouded over again.
But there is one objection.
Poirot took the words out of his mouth.
The height of the man. It is that you would say? With the exception of Monsieur Ratchet's valet, all the passengers are big men, the Italian, Colonel Arbuthnot, Hector McQueen, Count Andreni. Well, that leaves us the valet. Not a very likely supposition. But there is another possibility. Remember the womanish voice. That gives us a choice of alternatives. The man may be disguised as a woman, or, alternatively, he may actually be a woman. A tall woman dressed in man's clothes would look small.
But surely Ratchet would have known.
Perhaps he did know. Perhaps already this woman had attempted his life wearing men's clothes, the better to accomplish her purpose. Ratchet may have guessed that she would use the same trick again, so he tells Hardman to look for a man. But he mentions, however, a womanish voice.
It is a possibility, said Monsieur Bouc, but...
Listen, my friend. I think that I should tell you now of certain inconsistencies noticed by Dr. Constantine.
He retailed at length the conclusions that he and the doctor had arrived at together from the nature of the dead man's wounds. Monsieur Bouc groaned and held his head again.
I know, said Poirot sympathetically. I know exactly how you feel. The head spins, does it not?
The whole thing is a fantasy, cried Monsieur Bouc.
Exactly. It is absurd, improbable. It cannot be. So I myself have said, and yet, my friend, there it is. One cannot escape from the facts.
It is madness.
Is it not? It is so mad, my friend, that sometimes I am haunted by the sensation that really it must be very simple. But that is only one of my little ideas.
Two murders, groaned Monsieur Bouc, and on the Orient Express.
The thought almost made him weep.
And now let us make the fantasy more fantastic, said Poirot cheerfully. Last night on the train there are two mysterious strangers. There is the wagon-lit attendant answering to the description given us by Monsieur Hardman and seen by Hildegard Schmidt, Colonel Arbuthnot, and Monsieur McQueen. There is also a woman in a red kimono, a tall, slim woman, seen by Pierre Michel, by Miss Debenham, by Monsieur McQueen, and by myself, and smelt, I may say, by Colonel Arbuthnot. Who was she? No one on the train admits to having a scarlet kimono. She, too, has vanished. Was she one and the same with the spurious wagon-lit attendant, or was she some quite distinct personality? Where are they, these two? And, incidentally, where is the wagon-lit uniform and the scarlet kimono?
Ah, that is something definite, Monsieur Bouc sprang up eagerly. We must search all the passengers' luggage. Yes, that will be something.
Poirot rose also.
I will make a prophecy, he said.
You know where they are?
I have a little idea.
Where, then?
You will find the scarlet kimono in the baggage of one of the men, and you will find the uniform of the wagon-lit conductor in the baggage of Hildegard Schmidt.
Hildegard Schmidt, you think?
Not what you are thinking. I will put it like this. If Hildegard Schmidt is guilty, the uniform might be found in her baggage. But if she is innocent, it certainly will be.
But how?
began Monsieur Bouc and stopped.
"What is this noise that approaches?" he cried. "It resembles a locomotive in motion."
The noise drew nearer. It consisted of shrill cries and protests in a woman's voice. The door at the end of the dining car flew open. Mrs. Hubbard burst in.
"It's too horrible," she cried. "It's just too horrible. In my sponge bag, a great knife, all over blood."
And suddenly, toppling forward, she fainted heavily on Monsieur Bouc's shoulder. Chapter 14. The Evidence of the Weapon. With more vigor than chivalry, Monsieur Bouc deposited the fainting lady with her head on the table. Dr. Constantine yelled for one of the restaurant attendants who came at a run.
"Keep her head so," said the doctor. "If she revives, give her a little cognac, you understand?"
Then he hurried off after the other two. His interest lay wholly in the crime. Swooning middle-aged ladies did not interest him at all. It is possible that Mrs. Hubbard revived rather quicker with these methods than she might otherwise have done. A few minutes later she was sitting up, sipping cognac from a glass proffered by the attendant, and talking once more.
"I just can't say how terrible it was. I don't suppose anybody on this train can understand my feelings. I've always been very, very sensitive ever since child. The mere sight of blood, oh, why, even now I come over queer when I think about it."
The attendant proffered the glass again.
"Encore un peu, madame?"
"Do you think I'd better? I'm a lifelong teetotaler. I just never touch spirits or wine at any time. All my family are abstainers. Still, perhaps as this is only medical."
She sipped once more. In the meantime, Poirot and Monsieur Bouc, closely followed by Dr. Constantine, had hurried out of the restaurant car and along the corridor of the Stamboul coach towards Mrs. Hubbard's compartment. Every traveller on the train seemed to be congregated outside the door. The conductor, a harassed look on his face, was keeping them back.
"Mais il n'y a rien à voir,"
he said, and repeated the sentiment in several other languages.
"Let me pass, if you please," said Monsieur Bouc.
Squeezing his rotundity past the obstructing passengers, he entered the compartment, Poirot close behind him.
"I am glad you have come, monsieur," said the conductor with a sigh of relief. "Everyone has been trying to enter. The American lady, such screams as she gave, ma foi. I thought she too had been murdered. I came at a run, and there she was, screaming like a madwoman, and she cried out that she must fetch you, and she departed, screeching at the top of her voice, and telling everybody whose carriage she passed what had occurred."
He added with a gesture of the hand,
"It is in there, monsieur. I have not touched it."
Hanging on the handle of the door that gave access to the next compartment was a large-sized checked rubber sponge bag. Below it on the floor, just where it had fallen from Mrs. Hubbard's hand, was a straight-bladed dagger, a cheap affair, sham oriental, with an embossed hilt and a tapering blade. The blade was stained with patches of what looked like rust. Poirot picked it up delicately.
"Yes," he murmured, "there is no mistake. Here is our missing weapon, all right, eh, doctor?"
The doctor examined it.
"You need not be so careful," said Poirot. "There will be no fingerprints on it save those of Mrs. Hubbard."
Constantine's examination did not take long.
"It is the weapon, all right," he said.
"It would account for any of the wounds." "I implore you, my friend, do not say that."
The doctor looked astonished.
"Already we are heavily overburdened by coincidence. Two people decide to stab Monsieur Ratchet last night. It is too much of a good thing that each of them should select an identical weapon."
"As to that, the coincidence is not, perhaps, so great as it seems," said the doctor. "Thousands of these sham Eastern daggers are made and shipped to the bazaars of Constantinople."
"You console me a little, but only a little," said Poirot.
He looked thoughtfully at the door in front of him, then, lifting off the sponge bag, he tried the handle. The door did not budge. About a foot above the handle was the door bolt. Poirot drew it back and tried again, but still the door remained fast.
"We locked it from the other side, you remember," said the doctor.
"That is true," said Poirot absently.
He seemed to be thinking about something else.
His brow was furrowed as though in perplexity.
"It agrees, does it not?" said Monsieur Bouc.
"The man passes through this carriage. As he shuts the communicating door behind him, he feels the sponge bag. A thought comes to him, and he quickly slips the blood-stained knife inside. Then, all unwitting that he has awakened Mrs. Hubbard, he slips out through the other door into the corridor."
"As you say," murmured Poirot, "that is how it must have happened."
But the puzzled look did not leave his face.
"But what is it?"
demanded Monsieur Bouc. "There is something, is there not, that does not satisfy you?"
Poirot darted a quick look at him. "The same point does not strike you?" "No, evidently not." "Well, it is a small matter."
The conductor looked into the carriage.
"The American lady is coming back."
Dr. Constantine looked rather guilty. He had, he felt, treated Mrs. Hubbard rather cavalierly. But she had no reproaches for him. Her energies were concentrated on another matter.
"I'm just going to say one thing right out," she said breathlessly as she arrived in the doorway. "I'm not going on any longer in this compartment. Why, I wouldn't sleep in it tonight if you paid me $1,000,000.
"But, madame..."
"I know what you're going to say, and I'm telling you right now that I won't do any such thing. Why, I'd rather sit up all night in the corridor."
She began to cry.
"Oh, if my daughter could only know. If she could see me now, why..."
Poirot interrupted firmly.
"You misunderstand, madame. Your demand is most reasonable. Your baggage shall be changed at once to another compartment."
Mrs. Hubbard lowered her handkerchief.
"Is that so? Oh, I feel better right away. But surely it's all full up, unless one of the gentlemen..."
Monsieur Bouc spoke.
"Your baggage, madame, shall be moved out of this coach altogether. You shall have a compartment in the next coach, which was put on at Belgrade."
"Why, that's splendid. I'm not an out-of-the-way nervous woman, but to sleep in that compartment next door to a dead man..."
She shivered.
"It would drive me plumb crazy."
"Michel," called Monsieur Bouc, "move this baggage into a vacant compartment in the Athens-Paris coach."
"Yes, monsieur. The same one as this, the number 3?
"No," said Poirot, before his friend could reply. "I think it would be better for madame to have a different number altogether. The number 12, for instance."
"Bien, monsieur."
The conductor seized the luggage. Mrs. Hubbard turned gratefully to Poirot.
"That's very kind and delicate of you. I appreciate it, I assure you."
"Do not mention it, madame. We will come with you and see you comfortably installed."
Mrs. Hubbard was escorted by the 3 men to her new home. She looked round her happily.
"This is fine."
"It suits you, madame? It is, you see, exactly like the compartment you have left."
"That's so, only it faces the other way. But that doesn't matter, for these trains go first one way and then the other. I said to my daughter, 'I want a carriage facing the engine,' and she said, 'Why, mama, that'll be no good to you, for if you go to sleep one way, when you wake up, the trains go in the other.' And it was quite true what she said. Why, last evening we went into Belgrade one way and out the other."
"At any rate, madame, you are quite happy and contented now?"
"Well, no, I wouldn't say that. Here we are, stuck in a snowdrift, and nobody doing anything about it, and my boat sailing the day after tomorrow."
"Madame," said Monsieur Bouc, "we are all in the same case, every one of us."
"Well, that's true,"
admitted Mrs. Hubbard.
"But nobody else has had a murderer walking right through their compartment in the middle of the night."
"What still puzzles me, madame," said Poirot, "is how the man got into your compartment if the communicating door was bolted, as you say. You are sure that it was bolted?"
"Why, the Swedish lady tried it before my eyes."
"Let us just reconstruct that little scene. You were lying in your bunk, so, and you could not see for yourself, you say?"
"No, because of the sponge bag. Oh, my, I shall have to get a new sponge bag. It makes me feel sick in my stomach to look at this one."
Poirot picked up the sponge bag and hung it on the handle of the communicating door into the next carriage.
"Précisément. I see," he said. "The bolt is just underneath the handle. The sponge bag masks it. You could not see from where you were lying whether the bolt were turned or not."
"Why, that's just what I've been telling you."
"And the Swedish lady, Miss Olsen, stood so, between you and the door. She tried it and told you it was bolted."
"That's so."
All the same, madame, she may have made an error. You see what I mean? Poirot seemed anxious to explain. The bolt is just a projection of metal, so. Turned to the right, the door is locked. Left straight, it is not. Possibly she merely tried the door, and as it was locked on the other side, she may have assumed that it was locked on your side. Well, I guess that would be rather stupid of her. Madame, the most kind, the most amiable, are not always the cleverest. That's so, of course. By the way, madame, did you travel out to Smyrna this way? No, I sailed right to Stamboul, and a friend of my daughter's, Mr. Johnson, a perfectly lovely man, I'd like to have you know him, met me and showed me all round Stamboul, which I found a very disappointing city, all tumbling down. And as for those mosques and putting on those great shuffling things over your shoes, where was I? You were saying that Mr. Johnson met you? That's so. And he saw me on board a French messagerie boat for Smyrna, and my daughter's husband was waiting right on the quay. What'll he say when he hears about all this? My daughter said this would be just the safest, easiest way imaginable. You just sit in your carriage, she said, and you get right to Paris, and there the American Express will meet you. And oh dear, what am I going to do about canceling my steamship passage? I ought to let them know I can't possibly make it now. This is just too terrible.
Mrs. Hubbard showed signs of tears once more. Poirot, who had been fidgeting slightly, seized his opportunity.
You have had a shock, madame. The restaurant attendant shall be instructed to bring you along some tea and some biscuits.
I don't know that I'm so set on tea, said Mrs. Hubbard tearfully. That's more an English habit.
Coffee, then, madame. You need some stimulant.
That cognac's made my head feel mighty funny. I think I would like some coffee.
Excellent. You must revive your forces.
My, what a funny expression.
But first, madame, a little matter of routine. You permit that I make a search of your baggage?
Whatever for?
We are about to commence a search of all the passengers' luggage. I do not want to remind you of an unpleasant experience, but your sponge bag, remember.
Mercy, perhaps you'd better. I just couldn't bear to get any more surprises of that kind.
The examination was quickly over. Mrs. Hubbard was traveling with the minimum of luggage, a hatbox, a cheap suitcase, and a well-burdened traveling bag. The contents of all three were simple and straightforward, and the examination would not have taken more than a couple of minutes had not Mrs. Hubbard delayed matters by insisting on due attention being paid to photographs of my daughter and two rather ugly children.
My daughter's children. Aren't they cunning?
Chapter 15. The Evidence of the Passenger's Luggage. Having delivered himself of various polite insincerities and having told Mrs. Hubbard that he would order coffee to be brought to her, Poirot was able to take his leave accompanied by his two friends.
"Well, we have made a start and drawn a blank," observed Monsieur Bouc. "Whom shall we tackle next?"
"It would be simplest, I think, just to proceed along the train carriage by carriage. That means that we start with number 16, the amiable Monsieur Hardman."
Mr. Hardman, who was smoking a cigar, welcomed them affably.
"Come right in, gentlemen. That is, if it's humanly possible. It's just a mite cramped in here for a party."
Monsieur Bouc explained the object of their visit, and the big detective nodded comprehendingly.
"Well, that's okay. To tell the truth, I've been wondering you didn't get down to it sooner. Here are my keys, gentlemen, and if you'd like to search my pockets, too, why, you're welcome. Shall I reach the grips down for you?"
"The conductor will do that. Michel?"
The contents of Mr. Hardman's two grips were soon examined and passed. They contained perhaps an undue proportion of spirituous liquor. Mr. Hardman winked.
"It's not often they search your grips at the frontiers. Not if you fix the conductor. I handed out a wad of Turkish notes right away, and there's been no trouble so far."
"And at Paris?"
Mr. Hardman winked again.
"By the time I get to Paris," he said, "what's left over of this little lot will go into a bottle labeled hair wash."
"You are not a believer in prohibition, Monsieur Hardman,"
said Monsieur Bouc with a smile.
"Well," said Hardman, "I can't say prohibition has ever worried me any."
"Ah,"
said Monsieur Bouc, "the speakeasy."
He pronounced the word with care, savoring it.
Your American terms are so quaint, so expressive, he said.
Me, I would much like to go to America, said Poirot.
You'd learn a few go-ahead methods over there, said Hartman. Europe wants waking up. She's half asleep.
It is true that America is the country of progress, agreed Poirot. There is much that I admire about Americans. Only, I am perhaps old-fashioned. But me, I find the American women less charming than my own countrywomen. The French or Belgian girl, coquettish, charming. I think there is no one to touch her.
Hartman turned away to peer out at the snow for a minute.
Perhaps you're right, Monsieur Poirot, he said. But I guess every nation likes its own girls best.
He blinked as though the snow hurt his eyes.
Kind of dazzling, isn't it? He remarked. Say, gentlemen, this business is getting on my nerves. Murder and the snow and all, and nothing doing. Just hanging about and killing time. I'd like to get busy after someone or something.
The true Western spirit of hustle, said Poirot with a smile.
The conductor replaced the bags and they moved on to the next compartment. Colonel Arbuthnot was sitting in the corner smoking a pipe and reading a magazine. Poirot explained their errand. The colonel made no demur. He had two heavy leather suitcases.
The rest of my kit has gone by long sea, he explained.
Like most army men, the colonel was a neat packer. The examination of his baggage took only a few minutes. Poirot noted a packet of pipe cleaners.
You always use the same kind? He asked.
Usually, if I can get them.
Ah, Poirot nodded.
These pipe cleaners were identical with the one he had found on the floor of the dead man's compartment. Dr. Constantine remarked as much when they were out in the corridor again.
Tout de même, murmured Poirot, I can hardly believe it. It is not dans son caractère, and when you have said that, you have said everything.
The door of the next compartment was closed. It was that occupied by Princess Dragomirov. They knocked on the door and the princess's deep voice called,
Entrez.
Monsieur Bouc was spokesman. He was very deferential and polite as he explained their errand. The princess listened to him in silence, her small, toad-like face quite impassive.
If it is necessary, messieurs, she said quietly when he had finished, that is all there is to it. My maid has the keys. She will attend to it with you.
Does your maid always carry your keys, madame? Asked Poirot.
Certainly, monsieur.
And if, during the night at one of the frontiers, the customs officials should require a piece of luggage to be opened?
The old lady shrugged her shoulders.
It is very unlikely. But in such a case, this conductor would fetch her.
You trust her then implicitly, madame?
I have told you so already, said the princess quietly. I do not employ people whom I do not trust.
Yes, said Poirot thoughtfully. Trust is indeed something in these days. It is perhaps better to have a homely woman whom one can trust than a more chic maid, for example, some smart Parisienne.
He saw the dark, intelligent eyes come slowly round and fasten themselves upon his face.
What exactly are you implying, Monsieur Poirot?
Nothing, madame. I? Nothing.
But yes, you think, do you not, that I should have a smart French woman to attend to my toilet?
It would be perhaps more usual, madame.
She shook her head.
Schmidt is devoted to me.
Her voice dwelt lingeringly on the words.
Devotion. C'est impayable.
The German woman had arrived with the keys. The princess spoke to her in her own language, telling her to open the valises and help the gentlemen in their search. She herself remained in the corridor looking out at the snow, and Poirot remained with her, leaving Monsieur Bouc to the task of searching the luggage. She regarded him with a grim smile.
Well, monsieur, do you not wish to see what my valises contain?
He shook his head.
Madame, it is a formality, that is all.
Are you so sure?
In your case, yes.
And yet I knew and loved Sonia Armstrong. What do you think, then, that I would not soil my hands with killing such canaille as that man Cassetti? Well, perhaps you are right.
She was silent a minute or two. Then she said,
with such a man as that, do you know what I should have liked to have done? I should have liked to call to my servants, flog this man to death, and fling him out on the rubbish heap. That is the way things were done when I was young, monsieur.
Still he did not speak, just listened attentively. She looked at him with a sudden impetuosity.
You do not say anything, Monsieur Poirot. What is it that you are thinking, I wonder?
He looked at her with a very direct glance.
I think, madame, that your strength is in your will, not in your arm.
She glanced down at her thin, black-clad arms, ending in those claw-like yellow hands with the rings on the fingers.
It is true, she said. I have no strength in these, none. I do not know if I am sorry or glad.
Then she turned abruptly back towards her carriage, where the maid was busily packing up the cases. The princess cut short Monsieur Bouc's apologies.
There is no need for you to apologize, monsieur, she said. A murder has been committed. Certain actions have to be performed. That is all there is to it.
Vous êtes bien aimable, madame.
She inclined her head slightly as they departed. The doors of the next two carriages were shut. Monsieur Bouc paused and scratched his head.
Diable, he said. This may be awkward. These are diplomatic passports. Their baggage is exempt.
From customs examination, yes. But a murder is different.
I know. All the same, we do not want to have complications.
Do not distress yourself, my friend. The Count and Countess will be reasonable. See how amiable Princess Dragomirov was about it.
She is truly grande dame. These two are also of the same position, but the Count impressed me as a man of somewhat truculent disposition. He was not pleased when you insisted on questioning his wife, and this will annoy him still further. Suppose we omit them. After all, they can have nothing to do with the matter. Why should I stir up needless trouble for myself?
I do not agree with you, said Poirot. I feel sure that Count Andreny will be reasonable. At any rate, let us make the attempt.
And before Monsieur Bouc could reply, he rapped sharply on the door of number 13. A voice from within cried, "Entrez!" The Count was sitting in the corner near the door reading a newspaper. The Countess was curled up in the opposite corner near the window. There was a pillow behind her head, and she seemed to have been asleep.
Pardon, Monsieur le Comte, began Poirot. Pray forgive this intrusion. It is that we are making a search of all the baggage on the train. In most cases a mere formality, but it has to be done. Monsieur Bouc suggests that, as you have a diplomatic passport, you might reasonably claim to be exempt from such a search.
The Count considered for a moment. Thank you, he said. But I do not think that I care for an exception to be made in my case. I should prefer that our baggage should be examined like that of the other passengers. He turned to his wife. You do not object, I hope, Elena?
Not at all,
said the Countess without hesitation. A rapid and somewhat perfunctory search followed. Poirot seemed to be trying to mask an embarrassment in making various small, pointless remarks, such as,
Here is a label all wet on your suitcase, madame.
As he lifted down a blue Morocco case with initials on it and a coronet. The Countess did not reply to this observation. She seemed, indeed, rather bored by the whole proceeding, remaining curled up in her corner, staring dreamily out through the window whilst the men searched her luggage in the compartment next door.
Poirot finished his search by opening the little cupboard above the washbasin and taking a rapid glance at its contents. A sponge, face cream, powder, and a small bottle labelled Trianon. Then, with polite remarks on either side, the search party withdrew. Mrs. Hubbard's compartment, that of the dead man and Poirot's own, came next. They now came to the second-class carriages. The first one, numbers 10, 11, was occupied by Mary Debenham, who was reading a book, and Greta Olsen, who was fast asleep but woke with a start at their entrance. Poirot repeated his formula. The Swedish lady seemed agitated, Mary Debenham calmly indifferent. Poirot addressed himself to the Swedish lady.
If you permit, mademoiselle, we will examine your baggage first, and then perhaps you would be so good as to see how the American lady is getting on. We have moved her into one of the carriages in the next coach, but she is still very upset as the result of her discovery. I have ordered coffee to be sent to her, but I think she is one of those to whom someone to talk to is a necessity of the first water.
The good lady was instantly sympathetic. She would go immediately. It must have been a terrible shock to the nerves, and already the poor lady was upset by the journey and leaving her daughter. Ah, yes, certainly she would go at once. Her case was not locked, and she would take with her some sal ammoniac. She bustled off. Her possessions were soon examined. They were meagre in the extreme. She had evidently not noticed the missing wires from the hatbox. Miss Debenham had put her book down. She was watching Poirot. When he asked her, she handed over her keys. Then, as he lifted down a case and opened it, she said, "Why did you send her away, Monsieur Poirot?"
"I, mademoiselle? Why, to minister to the American lady."
An excellent pretext, but a pretext all the same.
"I don't understand you, mademoiselle."
"I think you understand me very well." She smiled. "You wanted to get me alone, wasn't that it?"
"You are putting words into my mouth, mademoiselle."
"And ideas into your head? No, I don't think so. The ideas are already there. That is right, isn't it?"
"Mademoiselle, we have a proverb."
"Que s'excuse, s'accuse. Is that what you were going to say? You must give me the credit for a certain amount of observation and common sense. For some reason or other, you've got it into your head that I know something about this sordid business, this murder of a man I never saw before."
"You are imagining things, mademoiselle."
"No, I am not imagining things at all. But it seems to me that a lot of time is wasted by not speaking the truth, by beating about the bush instead of coming straight out with things."
"And you do not like the waste of time?"
"No.
You like to come straight to the point. You like the direct method, eh bien. I will give it to you, the direct method. I will ask you the meaning of certain words that I overheard on the journey from Syria. I had got out of the train to do what the English call stretch the legs at the station of Konya. Your voice and the colonel's, mademoiselle, they came to me out of the night. You said to him, 'Not now, not now, when it's all over, when it's behind us.' What did you mean by those words, mademoiselle?"
She said very quietly, "Do you think I meant murder?"
"It is I who am asking you, mademoiselle."
She sighed, was lost a minute in thought. Then, as though rousing herself, she said, "Those words had a meaning, monsieur, but not one that I can tell you. I can only give you my solemn word of honour that I had never set eyes on this man Ratchet in my life until I saw him on this train."
"And you refuse to explain those words?"
"Yes, if you like to put it that way, I refuse. They had to do with a task I had undertaken."
"A task that is now ended?"
"What do you mean?"
"It is ended, is it not?"
"Why should you think so?"
"Listen, mademoiselle, I will recall to you another incident. There was a delay to the train on the day we were to reach Stamboul. You were very agitated, mademoiselle. You so calm, so self-controlled. You lost that calm."
"I did not want to miss my connection."
"So you said. But, mademoiselle, the Orient Express leaves Stamboul every day of the week. Even if you had missed the connection, it would only have been a matter of 24 hours' delay."
Miss Debenham, for the first time, showed signs of losing her temper.
You do not seem to realize that one may have friends awaiting one's arrival in London, and that a day's delay upsets arrangements and causes a lot of annoyance.
Ah, it is like that. There are friends awaiting your arrival. You do not want to cause them inconvenience.
Naturally.
And yet, it is curious.
What is curious?
On this train, again, we have a delay, and this time a more serious delay. Since there is no possibility of sending a telegram to your friends or getting them on the long distance.
The telephone, you mean?
Ah, yes, the portmanteau call, as you say in England.
Mary Debenham smiled a little in spite of herself. Trunk call, she corrected. Yes, as you say, it is extremely annoying not to be able to get any word through, either by telephone or telegraph.
And yet, mademoiselle, this time your manner is quite different. You no longer betray the impatience. You are calm and philosophical.
Mary Debenham flushed and bit her lip. She no longer felt inclined to smile.
You do not answer, mademoiselle?
I'm sorry, I didn't know there was anything to answer.
The explanation of your change of attitude, mademoiselle.
Don't you think you're making rather a fuss about nothing, Monsieur Poirot?
Poirot spread out his hands in an apologetic gesture. It is perhaps a fault with us detectives. We expect the behavior to be always consistent. We do not allow for changes of mood.
Mary Debenham made no reply.
You know Colonel Arbuthnot well, mademoiselle?
He fancied that she was relieved by the change of subject. I met him for the first time on this journey.
Have you any reason to suspect that he may have known this man, Ratchet?
She shook her head decisively. I'm quite sure he didn't.
Why are you sure?
By the way he spoke.
And yet, mademoiselle, we found a pipe cleaner on the floor of the dead man's compartment, and Colonel Arbuthnot is the only man on the train who smokes a pipe.
He watched her narrowly, but she displayed neither surprise nor emotion. Merely said, Nonsense. It's absurd. Colonel Arbuthnot is the last man in the world to be mixed up in a crime, especially a theatrical kind of crime like this. It was so much what Poirot himself thought that he found himself on the point of agreeing with her. He said instead,
I must remind you that you do not know him very well, mademoiselle.
She shrugged her shoulders. I know the type well enough. He said very gently,
You still refuse to tell me the meaning of those words, when it's behind us.
She said coldly, I have nothing more to say.
It does not matter, said Hercule Poirot. I shall find out.
He bowed and left the compartment, closing the door after him.
Was that wise, my friend? Asked Monsieur Bouc. You have put her on her guard, and through her you have put the colonel on his guard also.
Mon ami, if you wish to catch a rabbit, you put a ferret into the hole, and if the rabbit is there, he runs. That is all I have done.
They entered the compartment of Hildegard Schmidt. The woman was standing in readiness, her face respectful but unemotional. Poirot took a quick glance through the contents of the small case on the seat. Then he motioned to the attendant to get down the bigger suitcase from the rack.
The keys? He said.
It is not locked, monsieur.
Poirot undid the hasps and lifted the lid.
Aha,
he said, and turning to Monsieur Bouc,
You remember what I said? Look here, a little moment.
On the top of the suitcase was a hastily rolled up brown wagon-lit uniform. The stolidity of the German woman underwent a sudden change.
Ach, she cried, that is not mine. I did not put it there. I have never looked in that case since we left Stamboul. Indeed, it is true.
She looked from one to another pleadingly. Poirot took her gently by the arm and soothed her.
No, all is well. We believe you. Do not be agitated. I am as sure you did not hide the uniform there as I am sure that you are a good cook. See, you are a good cook, are you not?
Bewildered, the woman smiled in spite of herself.
Yes, indeed. All my ladies have said so.
She stopped, her mouth open, looking frightened again.
No, no, said Poirot. I assure you all is well. See, I will tell you how this happened. This man, the man you saw in wagon-lit uniform, comes out of the dead man's compartment. He collides with you. That is bad luck for him. He has hoped that no one will see him. What to do next? He must get rid of his uniform. It is now not a safeguard, but a danger.
His glance went to Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine, who were listening attentively.
There's the snow, you see. The snow which confuses all his plans. Where can he hide these clothes? All the compartments are full. No, he passes one where the door is open and shows it to be unoccupied. It must be the one belonging to the woman with whom he has just collided. He slips in, removes the uniform, and jams it hurriedly into a suitcase on the rack. It may be some time before it is discovered.
And then, said Monsieur Bouc.
That we must discuss, said Poirot with a warning glance.
He held up the tunic. A button, the third down, was missing. Poirot slipped his hand into the pocket and took out a conductor's passkey used to unlock the doors of the compartments.
Here is the explanation of how our man was able to pass through locked doors, said Monsieur Bouc. Your questions to Mrs. Hubbard were unnecessary. Locked or not locked, the man could easily get through the communicating door. After all, if a wagon-lit uniform, why not a wagon-lit key?
Why not indeed, said Poirot.
We might have known it, really. You remember Michel said that the door into the corridor of Mrs. Hubbard's compartment was locked when he came in to answer her bell?
That is so, monsieur, said the conductor. That is why I thought the lady must have been dreaming.
But now it is easy, continued Monsieur Bouc. Doubtless he meant to relock the communicating door also, but perhaps he heard some movement from the bed and it startled him.
We have now, said Poirot, only to find the scarlet kimono.
True, and these last two compartments are occupied by men.
We will search all the same.
Oh, assuredly, besides, I remember what you said.
Hector McQueen acquiesced willingly in the search. I'd just as soon you did, he said with a rueful smile. I feel I'm just definitely the most suspicious character on the train. You've only got to find a will in which the old man left me all his money, and that'll just about fix things. Monsieur Bouc bent a suspicious glance upon him. That's just my fun, said McQueen hastily. He'd never have left me a cent, really. I was just useful to him, languages and so on. You're apt to be done down, you know, if you don't speak anything but good American. I'm no linguist myself, but I know what I call shopping and hotel snappy bits in French and German and Italian. His voice was a little louder than usual. It was as though he was slightly uneasy at the search, in spite of his willingness. Poirot emerged.
Nothing, he said. Not even a compromising bequest.
McQueen sighed. Well, that's a load off my mind, he said humorously. They moved on to the last compartment. The examination of the luggage of the big Italian and of the valet yielded no result. The three men stood at the end of the coach, looking at each other.
What next? Said Monsieur Bouc.
We will go back to the dining car, said Poirot. We know now all that we can know. We have the evidence of the passengers, the evidence of their baggage, the evidence of our eyes. We can expect no further help. It must be our part now to use our brains.
He felt in his pocket for his cigarette case. It was empty.
I will join you in a moment, he said. I shall need the cigarettes. This is a very difficult, a very curious affair. Who wore that scarlet kimono? Where is it now? I wish I knew. There is something in this case, some factor that escapes me. It is difficult because it has been made difficult, but we will discuss it. Pardon me a moment.
He went hurriedly along the corridor to his own compartment. He had, he knew, a further supply of cigarettes in one of his valises. He got it down and snapped back the lock. Then he sat back on his heels and stared. Neatly folded on the top of the case was a thin scarlet silk kimono embroidered with dragons.
So, he murmured, it is like that. A defiance. Very well.
I take it up.
Part 3. Hercule Poirot sits back and thinks. Chapter 1. Which of them? Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine were talking together when Poirot entered the dining car. Monsieur Bouc was looking depressed.
Le voilà,
said the latter when he saw Poirot. Then he added, as his friend sat down,
If you solve this case, mon cher, I shall indeed believe in miracles.
It worries you, this case?
Naturally it worries me. I cannot make head or tail of it.
I agree, said the doctor. He looked at Poirot with interest. To be frank, he said, I cannot see what you are going to do next.
No, said Poirot thoughtfully.
He took out his cigarette case and lit one of his tiny cigarettes. His eyes were dreamy.
That, to me, is the interest of this case, he said. We are cut off from all the normal routes of procedure. Are these people whose evidence we have taken speaking the truth or lying? We have no means of finding out, except such means as we can devise ourselves. It is an exercise, this, of the brain.
That is all very fine, said Monsieur Bouc. But what have you to go upon?
I told you just now. We have the evidence of the passengers and the evidence of our own eyes.
Pretty evidence, that of the passengers. It told us just nothing at all.
Poirot shook his head.
I do not agree, my friend. The evidence of the passengers gave us several points of interest.
Indeed, said Monsieur Bouc skeptically. I did not observe it.
And that is because you did not listen.
Well, tell me, what did I miss?
I will take just one instance. The first evidence we heard, that of the young McQueen, he uttered to my mind one very significant phrase.
About the letters?
No, not about the letters. As far as I can remember, his words were, We traveled about. Mr. Ratchet wanted to see the world. He was hampered by knowing no languages. I acted more as a courier than a secretary.
He looked from the doctor's face to that of Monsieur Bouc.
What you still do not see? That is inexcusable, for you had a second chance again just now when he said, You're apt to be done down if you speak nothing but good American.
You mean...
Monsieur Bouc still looked puzzled.
Ah, it is that you want it given to you in words of one syllable. Well, here it is. Monsieur Ratchet spoke no French. Yet, when the conductor came in answer to his bell last night, it was a voice speaking in French that told him that it was a mistake and that he was not wanted. It was, moreover, a perfectly idiomatic phrase that was used, not one that a man knowing only a few words of French would have selected. Ce n'est rien, je me suis trompé.
It is true, cried Dr. Constantine excitedly. We should have seen that. I remember your laying stress on the words when you repeated them to us. Now I understand your reluctance to rely upon the evidence of the dented watch. Already at 1:23, Ratchet was dead. And it was his murderer speaking, finished Monsieur Bouc impressively.
Poirot raised a deprecating hand.
Let us not go too fast. And do not let us assume more than we actually know. It is safe, I think, to say that at that time, 1:23, some other person was in Ratchet's compartment, and that that person was either French or could speak the French language fluently.
You are very cautious, mon vieux.
One should advance only a step at a time. We have no actual evidence that Ratchet was dead at that time.
There is the cry that awakened you.
Yes, that is true.
In one way, said Monsieur Bouc thoughtfully. This discovery does not affect things very much. You heard someone moving about next door. That someone was not Ratchet, but the other man. Doubtless he is washing blood from his hands, clearing up after the crime, burning the incriminating letter. Then he waits till all is still.
and when he thinks it is safe and the coast is clear, he locks and chains Ratchet's door on the inside, unlocks the communicating door through into Mrs. Hubbard's compartment, and slips out that way. In fact, it is exactly as we thought, with the difference that Ratchet was killed about half an hour earlier, and the watch put on to 1:15 to create an alibi.
Not such a famous alibi, said Poirot. The hands of the watch pointed to 1:15, the exact time when the intruder actually left the scene of the crime.
True, said Monsieur Bouc, a little confused. What, then, does the watch convey to you?
If the hands were altered, I say if, then the time at which they were set must have a significance. The natural reaction would be to suspect anyone who had a reliable alibi for the time indicated, in this case, 1:15.
Yes, yes, said the doctor. That reasoning is good.
We must also pay a little attention to the time the intruder entered the compartment. When had he an opportunity of doing so? Unless we are to assume the complicity of the real conductor, there was only one time when he could have done so. During the time the train stopped at Vinchovci. After the train left Vinchovci, the conductor was sitting facing the corridor. And whereas any one of the passengers would pay little attention to a wagon-lit attendant, the one person who would notice an impostor would be the real conductor. But during the halt at Vinchovci, the conductor is out on the platform. The coast is clear.
And by our former reasoning, it must be one of the passengers, said Monsieur Bouc. We come back to where we were. Which of them?
Poirot smiled. I have made a list, he said. If you would like to see it, it will, perhaps, refresh your memory.
The doctor and Monsieur Bouc pored over the list together. It was written out neatly in a methodical manner in the order in which the passengers had been interviewed. Hector McQueen, American subject, berth number 6, second class. Motive, possibly arising out of association with dead man. Alibi, from midnight to 2 a.m., midnight to 1:30 vouched for by Colonel Arbuthnot, and 1:15 to 2 vouched for by conductor. Evidence against him, none. Suspicious circumstances, none. Conductor, Pierre Michel, French subject. Motive, none. Alibi, from midnight to 2 a.m., seen by HP in corridor at same time as voice spoke from Ratchet's compartment at 12:37. From 1 a.m. to 1:16, vouched for by other two conductors. Evidence against him, none. Suspicious circumstances. The wagon-lit uniform found is a point in his favor, since it seems to have been intended to throw suspicion on him. Edward Masterman, English subject, berth number 4, second class. Motive, possibly arising out of connection with deceased, whose valet he was. Alibi, from midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by Antonio Foscarelli. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances? None, except that he is the only man the right height or size to have worn the wagon-lit uniform. On the other hand, it is unlikely that he speaks French well. Mrs. Hubbard, American subject, berth number 3, first class. Motive, none. Alibi, from midnight to 2 a.m., none. Evidence against her or suspicious circumstances. Story of a man in her compartment is substantiated by the evidence of Hartmann and that of the woman Schmidt. Greta Olsen, Swedish subject, berth number 10, second class. Motive, none. Alibi, from midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by Mary Debenham. Note, was last to see Ratchet alive. Princess Dragomirov, naturalized French subject, berth number 14, first class. Motive. Was intimately acquainted with Armstrong family and godmother to Sonia Armstrong. Alibi. From midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by conductor and maid. Evidence against her or suspicious circumstances? None. Count Andrényi, Hungarian subject, diplomatic passport, berth number 13, first class. Motive. None. Alibi. Midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by conductor. This does not cover period from 1 to 1:15. Countess Andrényi, as above, berth number 12.
Motive, none. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m. Took Trianal and slept. Vouched for by husband. Trianal bottle in her cupboard. Colonel Arbuthnot, British subject, berth number 15, first class. Motive, none. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., talked with McQueen till 1:30, went to own compartment and did not leave it. Substantiated by McQueen and conductor. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances. Pipe cleaner. Cyrus Hardman, American subject, berth number 16, second class. Motive, none known. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., did not leave compartment. Substantiated by McQueen and conductor. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances, none. Antonio Foscarelli, American subject, Italian berth. Berth number 5, second class. Motive, none known. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by Edward Masterman. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances, none except that weapon used might be said to suit his temperament, vide Monsieur Bouc. Mary Debenham, British subject, berth number 11, second class. Motive, none. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by Greta Olsen. Evidence against her or suspicious circumstances, and her refusal to explain same. Hildegard Schmidt, German subject, berth number 8, second class. Motive, none. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., vouched for by conductor and her mistress. Went to bed, was aroused by conductor at 12:38 approximately, and went to mistress. Note, the evidence of the passengers is supported by the statement of the conductor that no one entered or left Mr. Ratchett's compartment between the hours of midnight to 1 o'clock, when he himself went into the next coach, and from 1:15 to 2 o'clock.
That document, you understand, said Poirot, is a mere précis of the evidence we heard. Arranged that way for convenience.
With a grimace, Monsieur Bouc handed it back.
It is not illuminating, he said.
Perhaps you may find this more to your taste, said Poirot with a slight smile as he handed him a second sheet of paper.
Chapter 2. 10 Questions. On the paper was written, Things Needing Explanation. 1. The handkerchief marked with the initial H. Whose is it? 2. The pipe cleaner. Was it dropped by Colonel Arbuthnot or by someone else? 3. Who wore the scarlet kimono? 4. Who was the man or woman masquerading in Wagonlit uniform? 5. Why do the hands of the watch point to 1:15? 6. Was the murder committed at that time? 7. Was it earlier? 8. Was it later? 9. Can we be sure that Ratchett was stabbed by more than one person? 10. What other explanation of his wounds can there be?
Well, let us see what we can do,
said Monsieur Bouc, brightening a little at this challenge to his wits.
The handkerchief, to begin with. Let us by all means be orderly and methodical.
Assuredly, said Poirot, nodding his head in a satisfied fashion.
Monsieur Bouc continued somewhat didactically.
The initial H is connected with three people. Mrs. Hubbard, Miss Debenham, whose second name is Hermione, and the maid Hildegard Schmidt.
Aha, and of those three?
It is difficult to say, but I think I should vote for Miss Debenham. For all one knows, she may be called by her second name and not her first. Also, there is already some suspicion attaching to her. That conversation you overheard, mon cher, was certainly a little curious, and so is her refusal to explain it.
As for me, I plumb for the American, said Dr. Constantine. It is a very expensive handkerchief, that, and Americans, as all the world knows, do not care what they pay.
So you both eliminate the maid? Asked Poirot.
Yes, as she herself has said, it is the handkerchief of a member of the upper classes.
And the second question? The pipe cleaner. Did Colonel Arbuthnot drop it, or somebody else?
That is more difficult. The English, they do not stab. You are right there. I incline to the view that someone else dropped the pipe cleaner and did so to incriminate the long-legged Englishman.
As you said, Monsieur Poirot, put in the doctor. Two clues is too much carelessness. I agree with Monsieur Bouc. The handkerchief was a genuine oversight. Hence, no one will admit that it is theirs. The pipe cleaner is a faked clue. In support of that theory, you notice that Colonel Arbuthnot shows no embarrassment and admits freely to smoking a pipe and using that type of cleaner.
You reason well, said Poirot.
Question number three. Who wore the scarlet kimono?
Went on Monsieur Bouc.
As to that, I will confess I have not the slightest idea. Have you any views on the subject, Dr. Constantine?
None.
Then we confess ourselves beaten there. The next question has, at any rate, possibilities. Who was the man or woman masquerading in wagonly uniform? Well, one can say with certainty a number of people whom it could not be. Hardman, Colonel Arbuthnot, Foscarelli, Count Andreni, and Hector McQueen are all too tall. Mrs. Hubbard, Hildegard Schmidt, and Greta Olsen are too broad. That leaves the valet, Miss Debenham, Princess Trakomirov, and Countess Andreni, and none of them sounds likely. Greta Olsen, in one case, and Antonio Foscarelli in the other, both swear that Miss Debenham and the valet never left their compartments. Hildegard Schmidt swears to the princess being in hers, and Count Andreni has told us that his wife took a sleeping draught. Therefore, it seems impossible that it can be anybody, which is absurd.
As our old friend Euclid says, murmured Poirot.
It must be one of those four, said Dr. Constantine, unless it is someone from outside who has found a hiding place, and that, we agreed, was impossible. Monsieur Bouc had passed on to the next question on the list.
Number five. Why do the hands of the broken watch point to 1:15? I can see two explanations of that. Either it was done by the murderer to establish an alibi, and afterwards he was prevented from leaving the compartment when he meant to do so by hearing people moving about. Or else... Wait! I have an idea coming.
The other two waited respectfully while Monsieur Bouc struggled in mental agony.
I have it, he said at last. It was not the Wagonlit murderer who tampered with the watch. It was the person we have called the second murderer. The left-handed person. In other words, the woman in the scarlet kimono. She arrives later and moves back the hands of the watch in order to make an alibi for herself.
Bravo, said Dr. Constantine. It is well imagined, that.
In fact, said Poirot, she stabbed him in the dark, not realizing that he was dead already, but somehow deduced that he had a watch in his pajama pocket, took it out, put back the hands blindly, and gave it the requisite dent.
Monsieur Bouc looked at him coldly.
Have you anything better to suggest yourself?
He asked.
At the moment, no, admitted Poirot.
All the same, he went on, I do not think you have either of you appreciated the most interesting point about that watch.
Does question number six deal with it? Asked the doctor. To that question, was the murder committed at that time, 1:15, I answer no.
I agree, said Monsieur Bouc. Was it earlier? Is the next question. I say yes. You too, doctor?
The doctor nodded. Yes, but the question, was it later, can also be answered in the affirmative. I agree with your theory, Monsieur Bouc, and so, I think, does Monsieur Poirot, although he does not wish to commit himself. The first murderer came earlier than 1:15, the second murderer came after 1:15. And as regards the question of left-handedness, ought we not to take steps to ascertain which of the passengers is left-handed?
I have not completely neglected that point, said Poirot. You may have noticed that I made each passenger write either a signature or an address. That is not conclusive, because some people do certain actions with the right hand and others with the left. Some write right-handed but play golf left-handed. Still, it is something. Every person questioned took the pen in their right hand, with the exception of Princess Dragomirov, who refused to write.
Princess Dragomirov, impossible, said Monsieur Bouc.
I doubt if she would have the strength to inflict that particular left-handed blow, said Dr. Constantine dubiously. That particular wound would have been inflicted with considerable force. More force than a woman could use?
No, I would not say that, but I think more force than an elderly woman could display. And Princess Dragomirov's physique is particularly frail.
It might be a question of the influence of mind over body, said Poirot. Princess Dragomirov has great personality and immense willpower. But let us pass from that for the moment.
To questions numbers 9 and 10. Can we be sure that Ratchet was stabbed by more than one person, and what other explanation of the wounds can there be? In my opinion, medically speaking, there can be no other explanation of those wounds. To suggest that one man struck first feebly and then with violence, first with the right hand and then with the left, and after an interval of perhaps half an hour inflicted fresh wounds on a dead body, well, it does not make sense.
No, said Poirot. It does not make sense. And you think that two murderers do make sense?
As you yourself have said, what other explanation can there be?
Poirot stared straight ahead of him. That is what I ask myself, he said. That is what I never cease to ask myself.
He leaned back in his seat.
From now on, it is all here.
He tapped himself on the forehead.
We have thrashed it all out. The facts are all in front of us, neatly arranged with order and method. The passengers have sat here one by one giving their evidence. We know all that can be known from outside.
He gave an affectionate smile at Monsieur Bouc.
It has been a little joke between us, has it not? This business of sitting back and thinking out the truth. Well, I am about to put my theory into practice, here before your eyes. You too must do the same. Let us all three close our eyes and think. One or more of those passengers killed Ratchet. Which of them?